This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.
Welcome to the Really Awful Movies Podcast, a celebration of low-budget cinema.
Is another apocalyptic prediction about to come true? Winds of death sweep across the world, and whole continents will be cast adrift in an ocean of blood.
Chris, and along with Jeff, we're bringing you the very best and worst of horror, sci-fi, action, exploitation, kung fu, and women in prison movies from the 1970s to today. Be sure and check out reallyawfulmovies.com for reviews, interviews, lists, and terrific movie giveaways.
Welcome to episode 6B of the Really Awful Movies podcast, a special episode, an interview with the associate producer and head writer of the hilarious House of Frightenstein and super hippie himself, Mitch Markowitz.
Another lovely day begins. The gruesome ghouls with greenish skin. So close your eyes and you will find you've arrived in Frankenstein. Perhaps the Count will find a way to make his monster work today. For if he solves this monster mania, he can return to Transylvania. So welcome where the sun won't shine, to the castle of Count Frankenstein.
This is a special edition of the Really Awful Movies podcast. I'm sitting here with Mitch Markowitz, who is the associate producer and head writer of the seminal Canadian kids series, The Hilarious House of Frightenstein. Now, when I say kids series, that's sort of limiting the appeal of the show, because I think fans of all ages basically have fond memories of the show and enjoy it. But it's an honor to be sitting here with Mitch and to chat. So, Mitch, thank you so much for agreeing to
my pleasure,
this interview.
Jeff. By the way, Do you have another website called Really Good TV Shows?
That we do not, no.
Okay. So I'm stuck with the really bad movies. Go ahead.
It's kind of works on two levels. So anyway, obviously, I mean, I think our listeners, if they haven't, I would assume that 90% of them have seen the show, The Hilarious House of Frankenstein.
I'm working now with three generations of fans, if you will. The original fans watched the original show when we did it in 1970-71. Mm-hmm. I'm also talking to, at all these show expos and live appearances I make, to their kids who watched the reruns 25, maybe 30 years later, and their grandchildren, believe it or not, who are being introduced to Frankenstein via Netflix or YouTube or the DVDs that are available. Okay. So it's quite interesting to me that there are like three generations of fans now. Sorry to step on your
question. Oh, no, no, no. I mean, it's like, because, you know, I wanted to sort of start off with, like, you know, this is like, you know, what the genesis of the show and all that, but we can get to that. But just to follow up on that, what do you
attribute? Well, Genesis is a good band, so go down that road if you like.
You know what? They're actually really, I'm a big fan. I kind of like the Peter Gabriel years a bit better than the Phil Collins years, but I still like the Phil Collins years. But before we talk about the genesis of the show and how it began and so on and so forth, what do you attribute the appeal of the show to? Why do you think that so many kids and adults just have such fond memories of Frightenstein?
Well, I guess, A, the fact that it's a pseudo-horror. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's nothing very scary. Well, I shouldn't say nothing very scary. A lot of people are scared watching The Librarian. He was the scariest aspect of Frightenstein.
I might tend to agree, yep.
But it was pseudo-horror. It was like an entry level, an entry drug, if you will, into horror. And there are lots of people I run into and have run into over the years who said, that they were introduced to this show when they were four or five or whatever.
That was me.
And it took them down that road. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever heard of Ghoulish Gary Pullen, who did the art, quite a famous horror artist. And he did the art for the DVDs, the jewel cases. Mm-hmm. He's done the Frankenstein posters. Mm-hmm. And he, again, like you, was introduced to the show when he was like five or something, and that determined which way he was going to go in his life. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of people like that. So I'm not sure if I answered your question, but I think it was the horror aspect. There was a little bit of everything involved in Frightenstein. It was like the Ed Sullivan Show.
Yeah.
You know, there was some humor. Mm-hmm. There was some physical shtick. Mm-hmm. There was some educational components, which were a necessity to get it, to get the show sold. When we originally proposed the show to Sid Bibby, who was the general manager of CHCH, mm-hmm. just to start in the beginning.
Channel 11, yep.
we originally sold the show to CHCH, Channel right. 11, mm-hmm. here, which is sort of a satellite of Toronto. Hamilton, for your worldwide listeners, yes. is about, I don't know, 45 minutes from Toronto.
Steel Town.
Yeah, Steel Town. And they had their own little niche in the market,
right.
but they were interested at that point in reaching into the GTA and getting more of the Toronto audience. Mm-hmm. And the only thing they had going for them at the time, I mean, I'm going off on a bit of a tangent, that's but hopefully right. you don't mind. No. The only thing CHCH had going for them at the time was they were known as the movie channel. Mm-hmm. They had a guy named Sam Hepshire who worked for them, and he had all kinds of connections in Hollywood and New York. And he would go to those connections and acquire films for use on CHCH by telling the distributors that you're going to be selling this to a small station in Hamilton. Nobody ever watches this station, so you've got nothing to lose. Mm-hmm. You can always release it to the big guys 3 weeks later. Meantime, CHCH got a leg up on the market, and they ran all the really, really big movies before CTV and CBC, all the national networks. That was their only claim to fame at the time. So we originally pitched the show to Sid Bibby, mm-hmm. and he was interested. He had a hole in their schedule. They didn't have a real in-house produced kid show at the time. They had a show called Tiny Talent Time, but it didn't fit in the same category.
I remember watching that.
It was like a Ted Mack amateur, a Canadian yeah, yeah. Ted Mack amateur hour.
Yeah, it was very amateur, as yeah. I recall. But yeah. anyway.
Yep. And very tame, if you will.
Yeah. Yeah.
So we pitched the show to him, and he said he was interested and give him some time to think about it. Mm-hmm. So we went back and came back to Toronto and thought about it a little bit. And then we decided that the best way to sort of close the sale, if you will, mm-hmm. was to make him an offer he couldn't refuse, to coin a Godfather phrase. And we met with Sid again, and we said, well, what would you think if we could get a real big Hollywood star to be the host of the show? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, like who? And just out of my mouth, my brother's mouth, I think it was my brother's mouth, he said, well, what about like Vincent Price?
You're sorry, let me interrupt. Your brother, Riff.
Riff,
you
yeah. guys, my older brother, who was mm-hmm. the executive producer of the show.
Yeah.
So Sid said, he sort of did a double take and said, listen, if you could get Vincent Price to host this little show in mm-hmm. Hamilton, I'd sign right here, right now, for 130 episodes. Mm-hmm. So we did the deal. Then all we had to do was find Vincent Price and see if he'd do the job. We got in touch with
him. Was he in the phone book?
No, but we got in touch with him through an agent who knew an agent.
Okay, yeah.
Spoke to Vincent personally and offered him this. And the offer was, we'll get you in and out of Toronto in a couple of days.
Okay.
All of your bits in a couple of mm-hmm. days. And he'd never worked in Toronto, so that had some appeal to it. Mm-hmm. We told him this was a kid show, and he'd mm-hmm. never done a kid show. And we offered to pay him, which I guess helped a little bit. So we had A, B, and C checked off. Mm-hmm. He said yes. We went back to Sid Bibby, and the rest is history. Now, at the time, we thought this pseudo-kid show that we were going to record, we were going to do 130 episodes. They'd run every Monday through Friday, mm-hmm. once a day. They'd last a year, and that was it. Everybody was happy. We got paid a bunch of money for producing and delivering the show. He would get an audience he didn't have mm-hmm. if we were successful. And everybody had a payday. Well, it didn't work out that way. Needless to say, 45 years later, the show is now the longest-running kids' TV show in Canadian history. And what really never ceased to amaze me was not so much the legs, although I'm still shocked that we're still around 45 years later mm-hmm. in some markets, and that there are still 300 people in line wherever I go waiting for an autograph and to shake hands and to tell me I grew up watching this show and pose for selfies and like that. What really took me aback was the stretch, how far the show went afield. It was syndicated, CHCH syndicated it across Canada mm-hmm. to recoup some of their costs. It was also syndicated throughout most of the United States and abroad. I did a show, Fan Expo in Toronto last year, and I had a young lady come up to me and said, oh, I grew up watching your show and we loved it and blah, blah, blah. And my parents also watched the show when they were coming of age. And I said, well, isn't that interesting? Very attractive young lady. I said, isn't that interesting? Where did you watch the show? And she said, in Spain. And I never even knew it played in mm-hmm. Spain. I did another personal appearance, a big car show at the end of the season. And I had a guy come up to me and said he had just watched it last year mm-hmm. in Norway.
Wow.
So, I mean, it played all across Canada, the United States, and abroad. Mm-hmm. And has, off and on, like I said, for 45 years. So, what was, to get back to your question, answer it directly, I think it had appeal on multiple levels. It mm-hmm. was funny, it was educational, which was necessary yep. to get it through the CRTC
definitely
approvals here in Canada. Mm-hmm. It was amusing, there was some slapstick mm-hmm. involved, and the variance in the characters,
yes,
I think, caught everybody. And the characters, the number of characters mm-hmm. kept growing and growing, and it evolved as we were going through the writing and post-production or pre-production
can
process.
If I can interrupt for 1 second, I mean, because I mean, yes, as you mentioned, there's a multitude of characters. I mean, obviously, you have Count Frankenstein, you have Igor, you have Brucey, that never came alive. The Mini Count, who I believe inspired Mini Me, right?
Yeah, Mini Me and Maxi Me.
Yeah.
You know how that happened?
No.
How we found out about it. Mike Myers, who mm-hmm. produced those Austin Powers films, mm-hmm. and he's Canadian. He was born in Scarborough, which is a suburb in Canada, a suburb in Toronto. Mike was awarded the key to the city mm-hmm. by the mayor, and at that ceremony, when he was accepting the key, he said, "I'd like to give credit where credit is due and tell you what my inspiration." I'd come home every day after school, and my mom would give me a plate of cookies and a glass of milk. We were running at that time from 4 to 5, Monday through Friday. And he'd sit and watch Frankenstein for an hour. Mm-hmm. And years later, when he became the superstar Mike Myers is, he was enough of a gentleman, because he certainly didn't have to.
Right.
He could have just taken all the credit for himself. Mm-hmm. But he was enough of a gentleman to say, this watching the Mini Count and the full size count mm-hmm. inspired me to do the Mini Me and Maxi Me and the Austin Powers movies.
Wow. So, I mean, the list of characters was on and on. I mean, there's Griselda, Librarian, the Wolfman. You played a couple, Super Hippie, yeah. the Mosquito. The Mosquito is one of my favorites. I don't know why. I just love seeing that big foot with the little mosquito.
Those throwaway lines.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Now, the majority of the characters were played by Billy Van.
Yes.
Now, I was wondering how much input did Billy have into the creation of the characters, and how much of it was scripted, written? In other words, how much was scripted, how much was improvised? You know,
well, the original plan uh-huh. was the whole show was scripted.
Okay.
The way that worked was we had rented a big house, I guess it's a sort of mansion, in a suburb of Toronto called Etobicoke. Mm-hmm. And my brother lived there, and I lived there, and it had too many bedrooms to even remember where each one was. And we put together a team of writers. And because we didn't get a fortune for the show, I mean, we got a reasonable amount of money for mm-hmm. those 130 episodes, but there were no fortunes involved there. Nobody was going to get rich by producing Frankenstein. Mm-hmm. But the way to keep as much as you can, obviously, is to spend as little as possible. Mm-hmm. So instead of going out and hiring 6 or 8 or 10 or 15 high-end professional comedy writers, we went another direction, and we got either amateurs or students. We got a bunch of kids who were going to Ryerson taking the radio and TV arts class, so they had a little tiny bit of insight into the industry, although they'd never been out of a classroom. Mm-hmm. We got a couple of friends of mine that I thought were funny, and just put together a sort of Motley Crue as another rock and roll reference.
Yeah, we
of writers.
Yep.
And we assigned them each.
We're big fans of Motley Crue at Really Awful Movies. But anyway.
we put together a teams.
Yep.
And each team would have a character they'd have to write for. And we gave them all a room, gave them some direction and what we wanted to come out with. And they wrote, and they wrote, and they wrote, and they wrote. And then they would give me all their stuff when they were finished writing it, and I would vet it. And if I thought it was good enough to go forward, I'd put it in that tray. And if I didn't, I'd give it back saying, let's correct this, let's delete that, let's blah, 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 like that. Well, when we finally got to doing some run-throughs with Billy, Billy was not overjoyed with the writing.
Oh, okay.
And I can't really say that I blame him, because he had his brushes with greatness and had done some big-time shows. Friend of ours, Alan Bly, had produced the Sonny and Cher show, and Billy was a regular guest on that. And he knew from what was good and what wasn't good. And I guess the stuff we had written wasn't exactly up to snuff, if you will.
Okay.
So what we had planned on being a totally scripted show ended up being probably 50% on script and 50% just off to the left, off to the right, down there. Billy was very fast and very good at ad-libbing. And he knew what we were trying to say and what we were trying to do in each bit.
Mm-hmm.
And if it needed some help, he'd throw in that help while we were shooting.
Because when you watch a scene, particularly the scenes with the Count and Igor together, Igor was played by
A guy named Fishka Reyes.
His nickname was
Kingfish.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When you watch, I mean, there's magic. I mean, you get the sense, like, this does not seem like, you know, two actors acting. It seems like two, you know, green-faced monsters, like, you know, are really, like, sort of interacting. And so, to me, like, you get a real sense that there must be some real, these guys are bouncing off each other. And
they have great rapport.
And they must have been having the...
And it's interesting because it started off a rather rocky beginning. I don't know if you know this story or not, but Billy was not our first choice to be the character.
Right, I was not aware, no.
Yeah, what we originally had thought... when we were at the conceptual stage, was we were going to try and insert as many sight gags as possible because we knew we were going to be dealing with primarily kids.
Mm-hmm.
We thought we were going to be dealing with primarily kids. It didn't work out that way. Ended up there was a huge university audience. But we'll get to that story in a minute.
Okay.
To get back to this one, we thought we would load the show with sight gags, which means you look at something and it's funny, and that it's a nice way to start. So we thought, what would be really funny, I mean really, really funny, Spice Girls, really, really funny, was we would get a huge Igor, and we sought out and found Kingfish, Fishka, who was about 350 pounds when he started.
Mm-hmm.
He was South African, had an interesting South African accent.
And he was
he was a singer, musician, did some stand-up.
Yeah.
Although it's surprising he could stand up for very long, carrying 350 pounds. And we tried to give him a sort of Transylvanian accent, but it just wasn't working.
Right.
So we figured, you know what, we'll live with the South African accent. And the truth is, it sounded good enough. It worked. And then we thought we would get to be currently politically correct, a little person to be the Count.
Mm-hmm.
Back then they weren't called little people, but whatever.
Well, I'm going to be a little bit, I guess, not politically correct, because the actor who played the little man his name was Big. He was Guy Big.
Guy Big, that's true. So, anyway, at the time, it was politically correct to refer to them as a midget.
Right.
Or a dwarf or whatever. But that. So, we begun a search that ended up taking us all around the world. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but certainly it took us all across Canada. It took us throughout the United States. Mm-hmm. And we narrowed it down to two or three people. One of them was a regular on the Andy Williams TV show, and he wasn't available contractually. He was locked in to stay where he was. We talked to a couple of other people. To make a long story short, as far as that's concerned, we couldn't find anybody that made us happy.
Don't call me a hippie.
A little bit of super hippie flying by. That's what happens every time I get an email, so I'll turn it down.
Okay. Now that almost sounds intentional, like we put in some audio effects.
No plan. My brother set up my computer, so every time I get an email, it's another quote from Super Hippie. Anyway, we finally found somebody right here under our nose in Canada. His name was Guy Big. He was 31 inches tall, weighed, I don't know, 14 pounds or something. I mean, a very little person with a very little voice. And we thought it would work terrific. I mean, it would look great. This little tiny Count and this huge Igor. Perfect sight gag. As soon as you see it, you got to break up laughing. So we hired them both, and we set up walkthroughs and rehearsals and read-throughs and things like that at the house we were living in Etobicoke. And the way that worked was Kingfish lived downtown, and he drove a Volkswagen Beetle.
Downtown Etobicoke?
No, Toronto.
Toronto. Okay.
Mm-hmm. He lived downtown, and he drove a Volkswagen Beetle that was in ill repair, to say the least.
Okay.
Guy Big, who played the Mini Count, also lived downtown. So the plan was Kingfish would pick up Guy, and they would come out to the house together for their run-throughs. Now, you have to imagine this. The house was set back from the street. There was a long driveway. This Volkswagen would come running down the driveway, and Kingfish would sort of ooze out from behind the driver's side because he was as big as the car.
Right.
Guy Big would have to jump down to the road from the seat. And they'd walk up to the front door together, come in. We'd go down to the area we had designated for our read-throughs. Mm-hmm. And then I took them from there. And we spent probably the first week together every afternoon. Fish would pick up Guy. They'd come out to the house. We'd read through the stuff. And I realized after the first 3 or 4 days, Kingfish was going to be just fine. He had a sense of humor. He had at least 3 or 4 funny bones in his body. Mm. He had a good accent, so it sounded like enough like Transylvania.
He was a good dancer,
5-year-old
too.
Kid. He could move.
Exactly.
he got all the check marks.
Right.
I realized almost immediately there was going to be a problem with Guy Big. Mm. A couple of problems. First of all, his voice was the appropriate scale to his size.
Right.
So he sounded like that. Mm-hmm. Didn't work too well for television. I mean, how close a microphone can you get? that sort of predated some of the fabulous microphones that we're using today in the industry. Mm-hmm. And certainly you can't get a boom in there because it would be in everybody else's shot, unless it was a one shot. Anyway, there was a problem with his voice. We could have lived with that. We could have figured out a way around that. The real problem was he didn't have a funny bone in his body. Mm. A nice enough guy, just was not funny. So I would read through the script, his part of the script with him, and I would do it every day. And I mean, just simple lines like, Igor, get the door. Like, you can't just say, Igor, get the door. In order for it to be funny, you had to have a Transylvania.
Igor, get the door!
Yeah. You have to do it like that.
Exactly, yeah.
He would say, Igor, get the door.
Yeah.
Didn't work. You'd say, my name is Count Frankenstein. 1 Frankenstein, 2 Frankenstein, 3 Frankenstein. Like, you really had to have a funny...
sense of humor
to be able to play the count.
Yes.
You had to have a really good sense of humor to play the count. So I finally realized it wasn't going to work. I had a meeting with my brother and explained it to him, and we figured we're going to have to draw straws to see who's going to fire him. And since I was the younger brother, and I was the associate producer and he was the producer, I lost. So I had to be the one to go in and tell Guy that he was fired. And I loathed the idea of having to do that alone. So I convinced my best friend to come with me. We'd been putting Guy up in a place called the Town Manor Motel, which was right around the corner from CHCH in Hamilton. So it was close. He could walk there. It was a half a block. So that would take him about 2 hours to walk that distance. Very small footsteps. So we went in. We met him in the bar at the Town Manor. And he somehow climbed up onto the bar stool. And Marshall and I sat there. And I didn't know how to approach it, so I had no choice. I just went straight at it and said, listen, Guy, it's just not working out. You're just not funny enough to play the count. And he took it like a man. He didn't start to cry or anything, because I was horribly afraid that's what was going to happen. And I said, but it's not all bad news. We're going to let you keep the tuxedo that we had made for you, the Count tuxedo. Mm-hmm. We're going to pay you what we had agreed to pay you. Mm-hmm. And we're going to give you another gig. You're going to have a part. You're just not going to be the Count. Mm-hmm. At that point, we didn't know what we were going to do with him, depending on whether he committed suicide that afternoon or not, after hearing this horrible news, because this was truly going to be his brush with greatness.
Right.
Even if it only was successful at CHCH, mm-hmm. it was still a big deal. So that was the end of Guy Big being the Count. Now we had to go out and find another Count. We looked around, thought about a bunch of people. My brother had was just finished doing a game show called Party Game for CHCH, a charade show. And the home team consisted of a guy named Jack Duffy, who was a very funny guy. He looked a little bit like Frank Sinatra, was a funny guy. Dinah Christie, who was a local songstress and mm-hmm. an actress. And Billy, Van. We thought about Jack first, because he had an interesting look to him. That didn't work out. Anyway, again, to make a long story short, we ended up asking Billy if he'd be interested, and he said yes immediately. And again, the rest is history. And the interesting thing about Billy was that every time we would talk about introducing a new character, he'd say, just a minute, and he'd turn around. 30 seconds later, he would turn back, and he had morphed himself into that character.
Wow.
Had an accent down, had a couple of lines, just throwaway lines that he could use. He was absolutely amazing, absolutely mm-hmm. the most talented guy I've ever worked with, and I've worked with lots of very talented performers over the years. So that's how he became the full-size Count, mm-hmm. and it didn't take long for us to figure what would be funny would be to use Guy as a mini Count. And worked out a few scenarios where mm-hmm. we could use him, and everybody was happy. He got his suit, he got his pay, he got to be a star of a television show. Mm-hmm. Little did he know, oh, wait a minute, this must be a better way to put that. No.
No.
Little did he know,
little, you know.
that he was going to end up being famous around the world
right.
for 45 years. Mm-hmm. Little did any of us know.
yeah.
Now, I don't remember what the original story was.
The question was. So. We were talking about all the different characters and the input into the characters.
So that's how more characters keep coming. We
right.
think about mm-hmm. Wolfman Jack. What if we did a disc jockey character? And Billy turned around, came back,
right.
and said, "I am the Wolfman." he just was perfect.
And see, that's the thing too. I mean, I'm chomping at the bit to talk about Vincent Price, but we'll wait about that. But I mean, okay, so a lot of the characters, the Wolfman, the Maharaja, the Oracle, in my mind, they all seem to be sort of like, I mean, watching it now, revisiting it now, not as a kid, because I didn't, they're just funny characters,
right.
but they seem to be sort of like, was it parody, satire of like 60s counterculture, right?
Yes.
And you're filming this in 1971, so yes. obviously you're not that far of the 60s.
Absolutely.
And
then super hippie. I mean,
of course, yeah, super hippie. Yeah. Now, I mean, knowing that, I guess your target audience at the time, you're probably thinking was what, maybe 5 to 8
yep.
years old?
Absolutely.
That sort of parody, that satire would go pretty much over their heads, but I guess you were kind of focusing on the parents at that point for those.
No, I think it was an accident. I think we didn't plan it that way.
Mm-hmm.
It just happened that way. Because the guys who we hired to write the show were all young.
Mm-hmm.
They were all sort of, I guess, in their mid-20s. We were young. Mm-hmm. I was in my mid-20s at the time. My brother was only 7 years older. So everybody that was involved was young. So we just, I guess, infused the show with lots of the things that we had just been through over
right,
the last
right, right.
sort of decade okay. or so. Interesting, again, to head off onto another little tangent.
Mm-hmm.
You're absolutely right. We had originally pegged the audience at being sort of 5 to 10 years old. That's why it ran when it ran after school
mm-hmm.
originally, and then it ran again before school.
That's when I saw
6 to 7
yep.
in the morning.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
A couple of interesting stories about that. My son, Julian, mm-hmm. decided to go to university in British Columbia, the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And we went out with him when it was time to go out and register and get settled in a dorm and things like that, my wife and I. Three of us went out together. And we got him registered and settled in the dorm and everything. We stayed a few days and then we left. My wife and I left to come back to Toronto. And he got in touch with us, telling us that about a day or two after he got settled in the dorm, he was, I think, on the fourth floor, and he went down one floor to the common room. And when he went to the common room, there was a big archway instead of a doorway, and he went and stood in the doorway, and a bunch of kids were already sitting in there watching a big screen TV, and sure enough, they were watching The Hilarious House of Frankenstein. And he watched, and about 30 seconds later, as pure coincidence would have it, I went flying by. And Julian blurted out, "Oh my God, that's my father!" And he was treated with a whole new reverence on campus following that little episode. The other interesting thing is that the show ran in different times, at different times in different markets. Mm-hmm. And Westinghouse, who was a big distributor in the U.S., Westinghouse bought the show for California, and they ran it on KTLA, which is the biggest station in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. And KTLA, there was a big story in the 1974 TV Guide in Los Angeles that was saying, the headline was something about KTLA bought a show and they don't know when to run it. So the first place they ran it was at 11:30 at night, and they ran us opposite Johnny Carson's Tonight Show. And interestingly enough, we had higher ratings than Johnny Carson did more times than not.
Wow.
Because there was a huge college audience that was going out and getting stoned at 11 o'clock and then tuning in Frankenstein at 11:30, because The Tonight Show was a very sort of square, conservative, Johnny was a Midwestern kind of guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, he shivered when Tiny Tim came on his show. And he was a sort of real normal conservative,
right.
Midwestern guy.
Yeah.
And it showed in his choice of attitude and guests and things mm-hmm. like that. So the college kids were all watching Frankenstein, and mm-hmm. there were a lot of colleges, UCLA and Burbank, lots of campuses in and around the Los Angeles area. Mm-hmm. So that showed us a thing or two, that it wasn't a kid's show, although ostensibly it was designed to be mm-hmm. produced to be that. It was appealing to everybody, mm-hmm. from the kids to their older siblings, to their parents, and it's been the same basically for years.
I mean, for lack of a better term, it's a trippy show. I mean, it's, of course, the Wolfman with the psychedelia and the dancing, yeah. and even the opening, the theme, March of the Martians, and we got to talk about Vincent Price right now, because
okay.
I'm not going to say I'm a Vincent Price fan, I'm a Vincent Price fanatic. I love the man. I mean, he's almost like the father I never had. Now, funny story is, I remember my mother, when I was a kid, "Oh, that Vincent Price is a scary man. He's scary. He scares me." And I'm like, "Vincent Price scary? No, he's so kindly and nice and friend." And, later on, I mean, as I grew older, I'm like, well, of course. I mean, my mother grew up with Vincent Price in the 60s, the Roger Corman,
movies,
AIP
yeah.
films, the ground plot adaptations. I grew up with Vincent Price on Frankenstein. That's, I think, the genesis of my love for Vincent Price. Maybe Michael Jackson's Thriller as well. But, I mean, to me, Vincent Price, I mean, there was nothing scary about the man. He was lovable. He was kindly.
You're right. He was lovable. He was kindly. Mm-hmm. He was probably one of the nicest guys I've ever worked with.
Uh-huh.
And there were some things that differentiated him between him and lots of other big stars. As an example, most of the big stars that I've worked with over the years, when they come onto a set, if they're friendly to anybody, it's maybe to the other cast members.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they're oblivious to the fact that there's even a crew out there. And in some cases, on a big show or on a movie set, there's hundreds of people in the crew, just completely oblivious to them. Vincent Price, the first thing he did when he came on the set was he went around, introduced himself to all the people in the crew, shook hands with them all, posed for a photograph with each of them.
Wow.
And then at one point, a couple of hours later, went out and came back with two cases of beer. I guess he got somebody to drive him. And came back with two cases of beer so he could have a beer with all of the guys.
Unbelievable.
I mean, a real, I can't think of a better way to say it, but a real menschy kind of guy.
Yeah.
A nice guy.
Everything I've read about Vincent Price, I mean, he just was the epitome of a man, sure, a gentleman.
Got
I mean,
a very funny Vincent Price story.
I'd love to hear it.
This is a good time.
Yep.
One of the provisos of him taking the gig was mm-hmm. that we would get him in and out of town in a couple of days.
Right.
So obviously his stuff was all pre-written, mm-hmm. and I'm guilty, I had approved all of it. We got on to the set. Actually, before we got out to Hamilton, we asked him if there was anything you'd like to do while you're in town, in Toronto. And he said, really, the only thing I'd like to do, I've heard all about the Mirvish Gallery, David Mirvish's gallery, mm-hmm. and I'd love to see it. Now, we knew, before he ever got here, we were going to keep him busy from 9 in the morning until midnight, mm-hmm. every day that he was here, because we had a whole lot of shooting to cram into a couple of days. So I called David Mirvish and told him we had Vincent Price in town, and would he consider meeting Vincent at some time other than business hours?
Right.
And he was just elated. He said, Vincent Price, are you kidding? I'd meet him at 3 in the morning. So we made arrangements to meet him at, I think it was 12:30. We finished that night, 11:30, came back into the city, mm-hmm. and David gave him like an hour and a half tour of the place into the wee hours of the morning. And everybody was very happy. He had Vincent Price, a world-class art connoisseur, mm-hmm. as his guest. Vincent got to see the gallery, and we had an hour and a half when we didn't have to talk and keep Vincent busy. Now, here's the funny story about Vincent. We went out to the studio when we got here, and during the actual shooting portion of the Price episodes, he was standing on what looked like a balcony on the Frankenstein set. I was lying on the ground below that balcony, and I had already spent, with the prop master, I had already spent weeks acquiring props that Vincent would use on all of his intros and extras. Mm-hmm. So I would lie on the ground and I would hand him up whatever prop or props I thought were appropriate for the next bit we were going to do. We recorded about maybe 20 minutes worth of Vincent Price intros and extras. All of a sudden, there was my brother, by the way, was in the booth helping direct the show. Mm-hmm. There was a director, but he was sort of supervising the direction because he knew what we wanted. Mm-hmm. And at the time, CHCH didn't have a real booth, if you will. They had, their operating booth was in a bus parked in the parking lot. So my brother was out in the bus. I was on the floor in the studio. Mm-hmm. 20 minutes into the shooting, my brother gets on the PA and says, Vincent, Mitch, we have to have a meeting. He came in from the bus. Vincent and I met him on the floor, and the three of us standing there, and he's looking right at Vincent and saying, Vincent, you're just not sounding scary. We hired you because you had the ability to be scary.
Right.
We want scary.
Okay.
And Vincent looked him right back in the eye and said, well, if you want scary, you have to write scary. It's all in the writing. I only read what you've written. And we learned a very valuable lesson back then that we both, I think, utilized for the last 45 years ever since then, that it has to be in the writing. Mm. If when you want to get a hit song, you have to have a hit song written, and then they
have to perform the song. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the TV show.
Right.
And these were all cute bits we had written. We had hired a couple of guys to do the Price bits. These were the most professional. They were two guys, Michael Boncour and Paul Willis. They had a comedy act they called La Troupe Grotesque. And they did, you know, ad libs and they worked a fair bit. So we hired them to write it all. They had written them. Everything rhymed. Everything was sweet and lovable. And it was fun, mm-hmm. but it wasn't scary. So we called Michael and Paul, got them to come back out of the house. We told them what the situation was, and we said, now you have to rewrite all 130 shows of Vincent, all the Vincent Price bits, and we're going to lock you in the room. You're not going to get any food and no washroom breaks until they're all done. So we did. We locked them into the room, no food, no nothing. 24 hours later, there was a knock on the door. Okay, you can let us out. They're done. And we let them out, and not to use this expression to death, but once again, the rest is history. Mm-hmm. They were all scary. Vincent read them as they were written, mm-hmm. and he sounded very scary, especially if you were 5 years old mm-hmm. and you weren't used to seeing him in all those Roger Corman movies. And Vincent was happy. My brother was happy. I was happy. Everybody was happy. Now, it still did take a little more than the 2 days we had promised him.
4 days, from what I understood.
Yeah, he was in town for 4 days.
Yeah. And is it true you only paid him his his daily rate? Like, basically, you paid him for what he would only get for 1 day, and he did the 4 days of shooting.
Yes.
Oh.
Yeah. He was a really menschy guy.
Yeah.
And he knew that this was a dream that we had, that we were going to do this show, and that to a large part, he knew also that we had sold the show predicated on him anchoring, if you will, the performers, because Billy was a star at that point locally. He'd done commercials and this and that, and he'd done a bunch of shows, but not a star of this magnitude.
Let me interrupt for one second. I mean, because, I mean, like what you said before, like you, how you sold a show based upon the fact that Vincent Price would be the show, and you had no, you had not even contacted Vincent Price.
Yeah.
That takes balls, for lack of a better word, right?
Yes.
If Vincent Price would not have come through, was there a backup in mind? Was there somebody else maybe?
No. If you think about all the major horror shows, he was the only one that was really suitable. I mean, you know, Bela Lugosi, had he been available, he wasn't sort of suave and debonair like Vincent was.
I could almost see Christopher Lee maybe slotting in. I mean,
yeah. He wasn't quite in those sort of top three. I mean, there was really Bela Lugosi, Lon Chaney, Vincent, who else was?
Well, Bella had passed on by that point, obviously, right?
Yeah, so, but I mean, had he been alive? Oh, yeah. I mean, who else was there that was...
Pierre Cushing, I mean, but these were not the top guys.
No, he was, there were only three, maybe Laurie, four maybe? In the top tier.
Okay.
So, no.
So, basically, it was make or break. If we don't get Vincent, the show is not going to go.
Yeah.
So that.
But the truth is, so I mean, just so you understand the situation and how it didn't seem like an insurmountable thing. It all just came down to money.
Mm.
I mean, that's what Vincent does. He's an actor. So I think even if he would have said no to the initial amount we offered him, it was probably a negotiation point. It was just how much less we were going to end up with at the end of the day. Because, you know, if the more you pay your talent, the more your soft and hard costs are, the less you end up in profit at the end of the day. So, but he said yes.
So you, and you, so you guys must have been ecstatic when he when he agreed.
And there's no big secret. We paid him $10,000,
and
that doesn't sound like very much money today.
Right.
But in 1970, that was a bunch of money.
Mm-hmm.
If you made $10,000 a day, that was a good payday.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he enjoyed it. I think he really enjoyed it because, although it was a real sweatshop operation,
right.
And you don't produce 130 episodes with that much stuff involved in those shows,
right.
Without grinding them out.
Right.
And his pieces were really ground out, because when you think about it, he did an intro and extro for every segment of every show. There was a lot of segments.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, we had a zillion Vincent Price pieces at the end of the show. The hardest job, I think, in that television show, by the way, the hardest job, I think, in any television show was at the very end, and that was the editing. And thank God I wasn't involved in that. We had a wonderful gal named Nancy Press who did all of the editing, and she was just sort of locked in an editing booth for months and months and months, taking all those Wolfmans and Griseldas and Dr. Petfed and librarians.
Bonnie Clyde.
All of those pieces.
and on, yeah.
And shuffling them all together and throwing in a super hippie there and a super hippie there and a mosquito there and another.
Julia Sumner, the physicist.
Julia Sumner Miller.
Yeah.
Story. Julia Sumner Miller. When he agreed and we said we would meet him at the airport, we went out to the airport with two vehicles, actually. There was a station wagon that we were going to put some of his things in, and he had some things we had to order for him here from Scientific Supply House, and some things he brought with him, and him. So we went out with a limo, my brother and I were in the limo, and one of our prop guys drove the station wagon. And he refused to go in the limo with us. He was just folk, and he wanted to go with his equipment in the station wagon. So the station wagon, we both left together, the station wagon got lost, and ended up going to London. We were supposed to go to Hamilton. It didn't exactly work. Should have gone in the limo, not the station wagon.
Yeah.
But he was a wonderful guy, had a real sort of Boston, New England accent.
Yeah. He was very, I mean, he was your pretty much your typical sort of, you know, mad scientist-esque sort of, you know, physicist.
Totally.
I mean, yeah.
Went to school with Albert Einstein. Yep. And I remember when he used to call my brother or me, he would say, Markowitz! He had a wonderful accent. He was a good guy.
Yeah.
A little strange, but he was in good company.
You know, it sounds to me that, I mean, there's almost a lot of like serendipity and happy accidents involved in producing the show. I mean, like, you know, first of all, by, you know, okay, so you had Guy Baig, he didn't work out. You fired him, he didn't get upset. You got Billy Van. Billy Van was incredible. You wanted Vincent Price. You got Vincent Price, which for me sounds insurmountable, but I guess back then you're able to do it.
Yeah.
Julius Sumner Miller being such a down-to-earth guy, Vincent Price being so down-to-earth.
And so famous. He was a regular guest on The Tonight Show, on Johnny Carson's show. I used to see him all the time before we worked together.
Like, so if it was me, I mean, I would just be pinching myself every day as I'm producing the show. Like, I can't believe this is happening.
There was no time.
No time, yeah.
There was no time. I get asked regularly when I do interviews, what was your favorite part of the show? And I have to be quite frank and explain that there was no favorite part. It was a horrible, horrible experience. It was the hardest I've ever worked up to that point and since that point in my entire life. All of us.
But that's the thing, though. I mean, when you watch the show, I mean, none of that translates. I mean, I think maybe some of that came out in the editing, but it's. I mean,
no, none of it showed.
Yeah, I mean,
I'm just bearing my soul.
Oh, I understand, yeah.
And but I'm telling you that it was a real sweatshop.
Mm-hmm.
And we all worked very, very hard. I mean, even the crew, I mean, we kept those crews going from 9 in the morning until midnight, almost every shooting day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can't do that these days. I mean, everybody's union these days, or if they're not union, they know what the union would allow and wouldn't allow, and they just say, well, I'm sorry, F you, I'm not going to stay 15 hours, 16 hours, 18 hours a day. There aren't enough free lunches in it to keep me here.
Mm-hmm.
But those guys, the CHCH crew, I can't say enough good things about them. They were to a large extent, they were all young guys. It was early in their career. They realized, I think probably before we did, because theirs was much more of a mechanical function. They were being directed by the director in the booth, so they just, you know, zoomed in, zoomed out, turn right, turn left. So they had time, I think, to actually think about this. And I think they realized that there was some magic happening there.
And you were too busy to...
Yeah, to do way it. Too busy to realize that.
Because, I mean, as I said before, I mean, when I was young, I remember turning on the TV in the morning, really early morning, and I would see these crazy characters. I would see the Count. I would see Igor. I would see Griselda. I would see the... Again, I said the mosquito for some reason. I love the mosquito. I just love seeing that gigantic foot and, you know, the... But anyway.
Can I give you a quick Griselda story?
Sure, yeah. Mm-hmm.
We had a secretary at the time. Mm-hmm. Secretary, receptionist. She was a jack of all trades. And she was... Her name was Norma. And Norma was in the midst of a sex change. Norma wanted to become Norman.
Mm.
And she was a real wild, over-the-top kind of personality. And when Billy first started coming to our office in the early stages, still sort of pre-production, he was sort of awestruck by Norma and her personality.
Mm-hmm.
And he fashioned Griselda after Norma. We used to call her, her nickname was Norma Jean the Sex Machine. And those woo that Billy would do for Griselda, that was all Norma. That was what she, that was her shtick.
Yeah, yeah.
Nothing to do with Frightenstein.
It's funny because Griselda was almost like a sort of like a campy Julia Child.
Drag queen, sort of,
Well,
that's what, now obviously the cooking part came from
Julia Child,
Child, who was very big at the time.
Mm-hmm.
But all that over-the-top, woo, all that's all Norma Jean the Sex Machine.
Wow, amazing.
And we were the only ones, it was an in-joke, we were the only ones that knew it, you know.
So, okay, so as a kid, you know, and it's funny because, okay, I want to, afterwards I'm going to talk about sort of this sort of being a gateway to horror for many young fans.
Right.
It took me a long time to become a horror fanatic. It wasn't watching Frightenstein. I just loved the show.
It just planted the seed, I guess.
And that seed took a while to germinate, right? But, like, I remember watching the show as a kid, loving it. Then when I was in my, you know, I guess late teens, early 20s, I think YTV started airing it, and I was ecstatic. Oh, my God, I could see Frightenstein again. Race home, turn it on, there's Frightenstein.
Right.
There's something about that show. I mean, it was a joy to watch. It's like... There's unbridled creativity. There's, you know, I mean, it's fast. It's everything. It's funny. I'm sort of like, you know, starstruck just talking about it, but it was a joy. It was incredible.
Well, speaking of it being the seed that sort of planted in you the road, to go down the road, the horror road. Mm-hmm. You know who has always told his audiences that it was his favorite television show? Alice Cooper.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. But see, that's the thing, because, I mean, the monsters, like, because I watched, I mean, in preparation for, you know, sitting down to talk to you today, I watched a few episodes yesterday just to kind of refresh my memory. And I'm looking at them, like, you know, these monsters really, you know, for lack of a better term, these monsters, and they were, you know, monsters, counts and Frankensteins, what have you, they weren't scary. They weren't scary. I mean, maybe I'm thinking of it now as, you know, an older... Yeah. But I think even as a kid, I found them somewhat charming, endearing. They were goofy.
I was a strange kid. I can show you hundreds, thousands of emails that I get from kids who said they would come down at 6 in the morning, turn the TV on very low so their parents wouldn't know they were watching it, and hide behind the sofa and listen to it. They were afraid to look. Like, they were so scared by Griselda's look. They were very scared of the librarian.
The librarian was probably the creepiest.
They were scared
when
the little bats would fly around. Mm-hmm. They were scared of the mosquito. Like, for some
people... Were they scared of the grammar slammer?
they were taken aback by the puppets, because that predated puppets being 6 feet tall and things. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, we had some big puppets on that show.
Right, right.
So there were lots of kids that were absolutely scared of that show. There's no question about that.
And that's funny, because, I mean, we have a podcast coming up soon talking about why me and, you know, Chris, how we got into horror. And I mentioned how until I was in my early 20s, I was afraid of my own shadow. I couldn't watch a horror save my life, but Frankenstein did not scare me.
Isn't that interesting?
It's really funny. And so before we, you know, started talking for the purpose of the podcast, we had the pleasure of touring your house and talking to you a little bit, and you mentioned that you're not a horror guy. You're not, you know, and...
Well, I mean, I did watch a few horror movies when I was a kid. I used to love The Mummy. Mummy scared me. How they would go and make the Tana leaves, and then the mummy would come back to life, and then like that. Well, now that I think about it, Frankenstein scared me, the Frankenstein monster. Before they started getting goofy with the mother of Frankenstein and the daughter of Frankenstein and the wife of Frankenstein and the brother-in-law of Frankenstein. But the original Frankenstein scared me. I guess the original werewolf scared me. I mean, I was as prone as anybody when I was a kid. But I was not a tried and true horror fan, not even remotely close. Okay.
And, I mean, in the years preceding Frankenstein, I don't think you were, you know... That's not your preferred genre of film, right?
No.
But so now you're doing conventions, you're meeting these fans, and you know, when I spoke to Lloyd Kaufman, he talked about being a bit of a Johnny Appleseed, kind of spreading the seed for indie filmmaking and so on and so forth.
Right.
In a sense, Frankenstein, you were also kind of the Johnny Appleseed, the gateway for people like me who ended up becoming these horror fanatics, right?
Yeah.
Who cover ourselves in tattoos of various, you know. And so we look to you and we look to Frankenstein as being that seed that was planted within us.
I'm not bothering you by constantly looking at your arms.
No, not at all, not at all. But I mean, you know, that seed was planted, right? And then over the years, it kind of grew and grew and grew, and we became these horror fanatics. And as we, you know, I mean, I don't want to get the whole thing about being a horror fanatic, but obviously, like, you know, we get sort of, you know, it's not the most accepted genre in the sense that some people look at you like you're weird or you're bizarre, why are you into this sort of stuff? But I think, you know, from... meeting tons of fans. I mean, we couldn't be nicer people, right?
Absolutely. And there are volumes of you. Mm-hmm. I mean, when I do the biggest fan show I do, I guess, is the Fan Expo in Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
And you're looking at upwards of 120,000 people over the course of a 3-day weekend there. I mean, there are legions of fans of horror at all different levels. Now, some are a little more extreme than others.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I have a friend of mine who was at the show last year, and he bought a skull to add to his collection, paid $2,500 for the skull. I mean, that some might consider a little bit extreme, but I guess Chris is a little bit extreme. he has an act called Mysterion, the Mind Reader.
Oh, okay. I'm quite aware of, quite familiar with Mysterion.
Yeah, and he's got a whole collection of what other people might think are scary things.
And now he's into wrestling too, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, actually, it was fun. He invited me to one of his wrestling bouts.
Mm-hmm.
I went and sat next to George Chaval. It was fun that night.
Shivala was in Prom Night 3, I believe it was, or Prom Night 4.
He gets one, around.
Yeah, he was, yeah. Good old George Shivala, one of our, you know, one of our top athletes here in Canada. Yeah,
that's true. Mm-hmm. So there are lots of horror fans. I wasn't a big horror fan, but it's strange because a good part of my life now, and for years, has been taken up in that genre between Frankenstein, which was a pseudo-horror show, and I did a film a couple of years ago, co-starred in a film with Academy Award winner Vanessa Redgrave, mm-hmm, which was a real horror-slash-supernatural film done by Rodrigo Godino, who is the owner and publisher of Rumor magazine, sort of the preeminent horror magazines in North America, the world for that matter. So I seem to have been involved extensively in the horror genre, whether I liked it or not.
So when you were that, how old were you again when you started?
Doing Frightenstein?
Yeah.
70, about 25, 24.
Okay, so you're that 24-year-old, you know, kid, basically, and could you have foresaw, I mean, that, you know, Alice Cooper would be influenced by you and that, you know, all of this stuff with, you know, you're making the show, you're working the sweatshop, you know, you're working fast and furious and feverish and all of a sudden, like, you're creating this thing that's going to maintain its resonance, its influence. And not just that, but it's reverence. I mean, people are people love the show. People, you know what I mean? For all these years, you know, 40-odd years. I mean,
the answer in one word is no. No idea. Mm-hmm. And it still shocks me. I ran into a fella last year at a show I was doing who came over and introduced himself. He was performing at that show. He's a fire eater and a stilt walker and a unicycle driver. And he said, you know, I grew up watching your show and it was my inspiration. And I now, as an adult, own 5 hearses. I belong to the spider, what's it, the name of the club? I think it's the Merry Widow Spider Club. Merry Widow Hearse Club or something. I mean, it's led to all kind of very interesting situations and very interesting people everywhere in the world, everywhere I go. And there are a few normal people, too, I mean, that look like sort of Johnny Mainstream. But there must be a little bit of evil inside of them to have liked that show, because it wasn't Howdy Doody. It wasn't Tiny Talent Time. It was weird.
It was weird. It was, as I said before, trippy. But as I don't know. I just remember as a kid, I just found these characters so endearing, so humorous.
The librarian didn't scare you?
Not really. Maybe, you know, probably that was the scariest of all of the bunch. I mean, and maybe even a bit of Griselda because of the, you know, the warts and everything. But I mean, I found Brucie and Igor to be such a great duo. I mean, they were hilarious. I mean, they were like my Ernie and Bert, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
As a kid. So, I mean, I don't know. And I'm sure, I know I'm not alone because every time I mention Frightenstein, in fact, I have a Frankenstein t-shirt designed by Gary Poulin, and whenever I wear it, not one day goes by that I've worn that shirt where somebody hasn't stopped me in the street and go, where did you get that shirt? I want that shirt. I remember that show. That's great. Watched it as a kid. I love it. So
that's great. I'll tell you the scariest thing about the show for me, as things evolved when we were in the pre-production stage, and we kept coming up with more characters and more characters, and it was a given that Billy was going to play almost all of those characters. We thought, we're going to need some really super-duper makeup here. And we did some research, and we found that there just wasn't, and no disrespect intended to Canadians or this country, because I'm a dyed and bred Canadian, but there just was nobody we could find in this country that was able to create the kind of makeup that we were looking for. I mean, they were perfect for the CBC. They'd go in there and do a little blush and a little lipstick and a little of eyeshadow, and you're ready to go on, but not what we were looking for. So we made some connections in the U.S., and we decided what we were going to do is we were going to go prosthetic pieces, which means they make a mold and they make noses, chins, cheeks, and then those are glued on and you put makeup on over them. And that's the way you could get the look of the show we wanted. And the best place to do that was at NBC Studios, which are at 30 Rockefeller Plaza in New York. So we decided who was going to go with Billy to make the molds. Mm-hmm. And again, I was the associate producer. My brother was the producer. I was the younger guy, so we pulled straws. I lost. And I, although I've flown extensively, I don't like flying. It wasn't my cup of tea. But time was of the essence. So Billy and I jumped on a plane. We went to New York. I knew about that. What I didn't know about was how we were going to get from the airport to 30 Rock. I thought we were going to take a limo, or a cab, or walk. I didn't know exactly how we were going to get there. Mm-hmm. But I was completely surprised when I found out the arrangements were we were going to get off the plane at LaGuardia, I think it was, get on a helicopter. The helicopter was going to land on the roof of 30 Rock. And if you've ever been in a helicopter, it's scary enough without having to land on top of a 52-story building.
Right.
I'll tell you, I had to change pants immediately on arriving at NBC Studios. And we went in and went through that horrible process where they make this thing you have to put on your face, mm-hmm. and it creates the mold. And then you can leave once that's done, and then they pour into the mold and make the various noses and this and that, mm-hmm. once they have a mold of your face. So 3 weeks later, the prosthetic pieces arrived back in Toronto, and it probably took me 3 months to get over that horrific trip.
Wow.
Landing on top of the NBC building.
Well, I mean, as a testament to how good the makeup was, I mean, and maybe this is also a testament to how non-observant I was as a kid, but I had no idea that Billy Bannon was playing all these different characters. I thought that the Count was played by one actor, Griselda was another actor, you know, all his characters.
That's what it was supposed to be.
And yeah, I mean, and I think also that's testament to Billy's talent, that mm-hmm. he was able to disappear into that makeup and come up with these new voices and these new accents and these new mannerisms and so on and so forth. Because again, like, I had no clue when I first found that out, that this was all these, you know, these myriad of characters were all played with the same person. Blew my mind.
Yeah, I don't blame you. You know, it's interesting. Somebody asked me, I was doing an interview a few months ago, and they asked me, and actually everybody who interviews me asked me this question, and I'm usually able to just slough it off one way or another. But everybody wants to know, if you were ever to do this again, if mm-hmm. we to produce the show again, who would you get to star in the show? And I keep either just avoiding the question altogether, right. or just saying, well, you can never do it again. But this one guy just kept hawking me and coming at it from all different directions. So I finally just...
Some fans are persistent.
Right? I finally broke down, and this was a real fan. Finally broke down said, okay, I got to give this guy some answers just to shut him up and move on to the next question. So I said, well, I could never do it again. We could never do it again. But, I mean, where would you get another Vincent Price? There is nobody else who could play Vincent's part mm-hmm. that I can think of. Nobody who was as suave and debonair and articulate and handsome mm-hmm. and versatile.
Aristocratic,
yeah, all those things.
Yep. And yet scary at the same time.
Let's put, very scary. Mm-hmm. And let's put Vincent aside just for a minute and let's think about Billy. Mm-hmm. I mean, where could you ever get somebody who could play that many parts, who is as fast as him, who is as funny as him? I mean, you couldn't. So the guy kept pushing, and finally he said, I know, but if some weird thing in the world happened and you ever did do
maybe
it again,
maybe he was angling to get cast himself.
Who would you get
to
replace Billy Bannon? Yeah. So I thought about it for a minute or two. This was maybe 6 months ago. And I said, you know what? The only one I can think of that could possibly fill that bill would have maybe been Robin Williams.
Ah. Okay.
And then 2 months later, the news comes out. There is no more Robin Williams. May rest in peace. But he had such a quick wit and such a funny mind. I could have seen him doing those parts.
How about Mike Myers? We were talking about him earlier. He almost strikes me as somebody that could have possibly...
His name came up. I saw Robin being better.
Yeah, no, I mean, you know what? It's not, as I'm sort of pondering it, as you're saying, it's not, I could see that.
He was a very zany guy.
Yeah.
And he had a huge energy level. I mean, he had the capacity to work for 20 hours mm-hmm. and be as funny at the end as he was in the beginning.
Right.
I see Mike as being more of a sort of lower key sort of person. Hmm. I mean, I'm sure he didn't have done it.
Okay, no, that's. I mean, that's interesting. And actually, that's. I guess that would be a good question to sort of. You know, I mean, Mitch, I have to say that I'm. Thank you so much for agreeing to.
Well, my pleasure to meet you. And by the way, your powers of observation have grown dramatically since you were a kid. You didn't notice this and you didn't notice that. You were in my house for like 4 minutes and you already know where most things are. I'm still trying to find out where they are. You already know about them. So kudos to you.
And not only do I want to thank you for the interview, I mean, I'm sure our listeners are also going to be very grateful. I want to thank you once again for Frightenstein because, as I said before, it was such a formative part of my childhood. I mean, I would say more than Sesame Street, more than Polka Dot Door, you know? More than Mr. Rogers.
Oh, I'm so happy to hear
Frightenstein. I mean, that was...
I'm so happy to hear that. If your fans are, your listeners are interested, they're more than welcome to sort of keep in touch with me through the website. We have a fan-based
website. Actually, this is a good time for you to plug your website.
Yeah, it's Super Hippie. Mm-hmm. SuperHippy. .com. That's easy. And it's quite an extensive website. The guys who put it together spent 6 months putting it together. And it tells you my whole history, back from the first foray into show business right up through today, mm-hmm. more or less.
And you're on Twitter as well, so you can...
I am. It's I'm TV Super Hippie. I am TVS... SuperHippy. I'm TV's Super Hippie.
Fantastic. Well, once again, Mitch, thank you so much. And
good meeting you. Thank you for coming out on this cold winter, blustery, snowy day.
Typical Toronto, you know, winter day. And thank you for having me in your home. It's been a real honor and a pleasure.
My pleasure. And hello to your fans worldwide. And good luck with your show.
Thank you. And once again, that's... www.superhippie.com and we're at www.reallyawfulmovies.com. So that's our interview with Mitch Markowitz, Super Hippie himself, and I hope you enjoyed it. We'll talk to you soon.